Hey, I'm here at your Metro PCS store. What's the best deal I can get for switching over?
How does a free smartphone sound?
Sounds good, but is it a tiny smartphone?
Nope, 5-inch HD screen.
Good brand?
Great brand. Samsung, and it's a Galaxy.
So I got a free Samsung Galaxy?
Yeah, you're a tough man to bargain with.
Everyone gets a free Samsung Galaxy on 5 at Metro PCS. Switch today and get a free smartphone after instant rebate. Yes, a free Samsung Galaxy. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out. Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included. Not valid for numbers currently on the T-Mobile network. See store for details, terms and conditions, and network info.
Welcome to Human Lab, the science between us. This is Amy Elkhorn, science-based, nationally syndicated columnist, and your host. Stay tuned for what promises to be a fascinating and surprising hour with my guest, Dr. Jonathan Gottschall, who is both an English professor and a recently retired cage fighter. So, as a woman and a person with the wrists of an 8-year-old child, I don't get in a lot of fist fights. In fact, in that I'm like most English professors. Now, to get you in the spirit of tonight's show, I'm going to read you a few sentences from The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch, the book by Dr. Jonathan Gottschall that we'll be talking about tonight. So here's what he says. As a rule, English professors don't approve of blood sport, and they also don't approve much of the kind of raw masculinity that's on display in a cage fight. In higher education generally, and literary studies specifically, masculinity is associated with everything oafish, bullying, and oppressive. Masculinity is a problem. It's not something that should really be tolerated, much less celebrated. On the contrary, it should be relentlessly dissected, suppressed, and ultimately transformed into something better, something gentler, more egalitarian, more cooperative, something closer to femininity. Well, let's just say my guest tonight burned the doilies of the English department and went on a fascinating and bruising journey when he laces with behavioral science. So stick with us as he tells us what he learned about men, masculinity, why men fight, and why we all like to watch. Hello, Jonathan.
Hey, Amy. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, I'm so excited to have you. First, just tell us how you, an English professor, ended up in a cage fight.
Well, it's kind of a strange story, as you can imagine. I'm at my English department office. It's a cubicle that I share with other adjuncts. I'm an adjunct, pushing up on about 40 years old, never really made it onto the tenure track. One day I look out the front window, and there's this new business that's moved in across the street. It's one of these cage fighting gyms. And the funny thing about it was, you know, I thought that juxtaposition of the savagery of the MMA gym across the street and the, you know, cultured English department on my side of the street, I thought that was a funny juxtaposition. But I started watching these guys in the cage, and I could see them through my window, but, you know, they're about 100 feet away. I could see them dancing and hitting and tackling and rolling. And I had this really unexpected emotion. The emotion was envy. I envied those young guys. They seemed so alive and so brave over there in the cage. And I felt like I was sort of just kind of rotting away inside my office cubicle. And so I said, hey, maybe I'll go over there and join them. And maybe there's a book in it, too, a book that's sort of a nonfiction version of Fight Club. I go across the street. I try to learn how to fight. And along the way, though, I'd be asking those really big, basic, ancient questions about violence and about why men are the way they are.
Yeah, it's really fascinating, this journey you go on. And I just wanted to explain to people, so in case you aren't academia adjacent or anything, adjuncts are pretty much the squash bugs of academia. They don't get any pay, or, you know, they're there to teach and then sort of drop kick out the door. So it makes sense that you felt this way, you know, that you were looking for this excitement like that.
Yeah, I was looking for excitement. And also, I mean, just to be honest, you know, I was looking for a way to get myself out of my job. I was thinking to myself, you know, I was almost 40. I could see that academia wasn't working out for me, but I didn't really have the courage to quit my job. So I fantasize all the time, how can I get out of this job? I don't seem to have the courage to quit it. Well, maybe I can do something that's outrageous enough, offensive enough to get my bosses to fire me. And so that was part of it. I thought they would see me across the street in the cage, involved in this sort of human version of dogfighting. And I was hoping that they would, you know, say, well, this is just beyond the pale, and throw me out of my ear.
They actually were more charitable than that. But I want to get to your wife. And that was really interesting to read at the end of the book. But I have this note: your wife was behind the way, and I believe upon hearing of your ambitions, she said, "You'll be killed. You have no skills."
Yeah, which was a very, ladies, you should not say that to your husband, even if it's true. But it was true. She wanted to know why I was doing it. You know, this is crazy. You'll be killed. You have no skills. There was a sort of lunacy to the project. But the truth is, I had a whole constellation of reasons for wanting to do it. You know, the first was I was honestly interested in the subject. I had a long-standing sort of professional, scholarly interest in violence. I'd written about it in the past. I had long-standing interests in gender and gender dynamics, controversies about gender, and those questions about why men are the way they are. And I also had these personal issues. You know, I wanted to know. You know, watching those guys in the cage, I was thinking to myself, I don't think I've ever done that. I don't think I've ever done a brave thing, not a physically brave thing. I've done intellectually brave things before, but I wasn't sure if I'd ever done a physically brave thing before. So one of the things I wanted to discover by going across the street and fighting in the cage was, am I or am I not, you know, a coward? And it's one of those questions that I think nags at a lot of men, and I really didn't know the answer to it.
Yeah, and what was really illuminating to me from reading your book, and I think women should really be reading this, it's how essential fighting is to being male. And I know some of this. You quote Joyce Benenson's research, and I know her work and Ann Campbell's very well. But you really underscore a lot of it by going into all these different areas. We'll get to the duel, but I want you to explain to us what you call the monkey dance. What is the monkey dance?
Yeah, the monkey dance is sort of, I mean, there's a whole bunch of different levels to the book, but the sort of spine of the book intellectually is something I call the monkey dance. And the monkey dance is, like, have you ever seen, like, you know, a nature video of a couple of elephant seals clashing in the surf or a couple of male deer, you know, cracking skulls on a hillside? You know, biologists call those kinds of contests, they call it ritual combat. They're ways that different animal species have devised for figuring out who the bigger, tougher, fitter, fiercer, stronger animal is, usually the male animal, without the cost of fighting it out to the absolute death. And humans are animals too. We're complicated animals, we're cultured animals, but we're animals still. And the monkey dance is the name I have adapted for human versions of ritual combat, everything from deadly duels to verbal duels to the play fights of boys to sports. And the crucial thing to know about the monkey dance is it often seems really silly. It seems kind of pathetic. That's kind of why, part of why I call it the monkey dance, to kind of make fun of it a little bit. But as with animal versions of ritual combat, they're a good thing in the end. They help us work out our hierarchies, thrash out our differences in ways that fall short of all-out, you know, ultraviolence.
Yeah, and this was an important thing I kept seeing in the book, that the ritual of the fighting in these kinds of fights, like the mixed martial arts or football or even pistols at dawn, that these things actually minimize carnage and social chaos. There are restraints built in.
Yeah, I mean, the where that seems craziest, that idea, is with the duel, you know, because these guys were, you know, lining up, you know, across from each other, oftentimes like 10 yards away, and standing still and taking shots at each other. It could be deadly. A lot of good people lost their lives doing this. But the duel was only barbaric in contrast to a utopic alternative of peace and love and understanding. That really wasn't the alternative back in the day. The alternative to the duel was the carnage of the blood feud. It was the vendetta, the back and forth killings. So the duel was always about limiting carnage. It limited it to the two aggrieved parties, and it limited it to a kind of dance-like form of violence, where the goal of it was rarely to kill the other guy. The goal of it was to show up, take the shot, and more importantly, receive fire, just to make a sort of demonstration, to signal to the world that you were brave, that you were courageous, and that your honor was literally worth more to you than your life.
Yeah, this was really fascinating. And you make this point that men used to fight duels over what we consider trifles, loose words, rumors, an untoward glance at somebody's wife. Both Alexander Hamilton and his son died in a duel. But you say that they actually didn't, they weren't reckless in risking their lives. There was a lot at stake here, that there was social ruin and a lot more if they didn't risk their lives.
Yeah, I think, you know, to me, I can read over the details of the death of Alexander Hamilton and his son, Philip Hamilton, and almost bring myself to tears every time. Because these were not men who were suicidal, and these were not men who were violent. These were not men who lusted for blood. These are men who found themselves stuck. They were very much stuck. So Alexander Hamilton, you know, was killed by the sitting vice president, Aaron Burr, but not before struggling heroically to get himself out of this fight. And he tried in all sorts of ways to sort of weasel out of the fight, but he couldn't in the end. If he would have weaseled out of the fight, Burr would have literally posted him in the morning. He would have posted the news, printed it out, put it up all over town, that Hamilton was a coward and that he had dodged the duel. And so Hamilton fought not because he wanted to kill, but because he so much wanted to live. And to dodge the duel was in many ways a fate worse than death. If Hamilton died in the duel, he would still retain his honor. His family would be okay. But if he dodged the duel, it wouldn't just ruin his life. It would ruin his whole family's life. It would diminish his children's prospects in business and in romance. His wife wouldn't be able to show her face in polite society. These were men who were very much sort of trapped by the dueling codes of their day.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll discuss the sometimes deadly culture of honor. This is Amy Alcon's Human Lab on blogtalkradio.com.
Hey, I'm here at your Metro PCS store. What's the best deal I can get for switching over?
How does a free smartphone sound?
Sounds good, but is it a tiny smartphone?
Nope, 5-inch HD screen.
Good brand?
Great brand. Samsung, and it's a Galaxy.
So I got a free Samsung Galaxy?
Yeah, you're a tough man to bargain with.
Everyone gets a free Samsung Galaxy On 5 at Metro PCS. Switch today and get a free smartphone after instant rebate. Yes, a free Samsung Galaxy. Metro PCS. Wireless. Figured out. Coverage not available in some areas. Sales tax not included. Not valid for numbers currently on the T-Mobile network. See store for details, terms and conditions, and network info.
I'm back with my guest, Dr. Jonathan Gottschall. So tell us about a culture of honor, what that is, what that meant.
Well, I think it's sort of debatable whether or not we're living in a culture of honor. I think to some extent we are. The duel, in the sense of, you know, the sort of highly formalized, aristocratic European duel, that is dead and gone. But the whole psychology of honor that led those men to think it was worth it to risk their life, to put everything up over some tiny little slight. For instance, Philip Hamilton died because some man called him a rascal. That was it. That whole psychology of male honor, that is alive and well. When men get into fights today, when they have disputes, when they kill each other, when they fight with their fists, it is still most often over these little trivial insults, these little disses. And it's still very much over matters of honor. So there is a sense in which, although we don't fight aristocratic duels anymore, the duel in the sense of an escalating conflict over an insult or over honor, that is still the leading cause of homicide in America.
Oh, yes, and I do realize that, but you make this point, which I also realize, where you say government removes the need, at least, you know, for a great deal of the culture of honor. You still have guys in bar fights like that fighting for their honor, but that the rule of law does remove some of it.
For sure, yeah, for sure, yeah. Because the fighting the duel always seems so irrational. Some guy calls you a rascal and you risk your life. So it seems crazy. It's totally crazy. But from another point of view, it's completely sane and smart, because the duel was never about the insult. That insult is spilled milk. The duel is always about deterrence It's about keeping the other guy from even thinking about spilling your milk or even looking at it, because you've already demonstrated that I will literally fight you to the death over any sort of trespass you make against me. But then the state gets really strong. And the state says, well, we're going to step in and we're going to enforce the rules. We're going to be the ones who step in and, protect people. And so people don't need to keep up that deterrence anymore. So I think I say something in the book like, the state stepped in all of its power so that individual men could afford to step down, to back down a little bit.
And you talk about this, too. It's a proving ground. It's a costly signal, which is a signal that's very hard to fake because it's something that's not given away cheaply, your life, not put in the line cheaply. And also, this is a mating signal for women, that the kind of guy who stands his ground, he's the kind of guy women want.
Yeah. I mean, this is like one of these incredibly un-PC things. But you read back through the history of the duel, and there was this incredible sort of aphrodisiac effect that accrued to men who fought duels. It was one of the reasons that men were so goddamn eager to fight duels. It's because women gravitated towards him. Oh, isn't he dashing? Isn't he brave? Look at him. Duels were often fought over women in one way or another, and they were often fought for women because in some cultural contexts, it was pretty much impossible to win a bride of quality if you had not first demonstrated that you were this kind of man, if you hadn't gone through this particularly masculine rite of passage.
And actually, you reference Ann Campbell's work. She and Joyce Benenson are two of the main researchers on sex differences. And she notes that the attributes that allow a man to successfully compete with other men, or you note this from her work, physically, economically, socially compete with other men, those things pretty much sum up what turns women on.
Right. Yes, exactly. I think one of the things I did in the book, too, is I sort of expand the dual concept, I have the duel as being one form of the monkey dance. Another monkey dance is sports. And so, one of the chapters in the book is about the riddle of sports. How weird is this that we care so much about these sweaty games? Why do people, and men in particular, invest so much, so many resources in this, so much time, so much energy? Why do they care so much? And one of the answers seems to be that chicks dig it. It's something that women really gravitate to. One of the things that struck me very powerfully in the book was thinking about what women find physically attractive. And if you look at a sort of an ideal male form, something like, the statue of David, you have this sort of timeless ideal of physical attractiveness. And you see this really poignant, lovely and terrible paradox in the beauty of men. And it's that David is a warrior. And just about everything that we find physically attractive about him is attractive precisely because it's an index of his ability to project physical force. It's an index of his capacity for violence. There is a sense in which I think for very good, evolutionary, biological reasons, women are attracted to people to mates like this, men who are strong and fit and fast.
And what's interesting, and brave, well, because all those things, they sort of tie together. I mean, you can be strong and not brave. But what's really interesting, because as you said, you're not PC, I am certainly not either. And men do not care whether their prospective mate, if they're heterosexual, can dominate other women physically or otherwise. Doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's really irrelevant. I think this is just, one of the things, if you're a grown up, you just have to accept. Kissinger has this great line about, he's this really physically unattractive guy, but he says in a lecherous way, power is the ultimate aphrodisiac, sort of bragging about his conquests. because he's so powerful, he was attractive. It just doesn't seem to work the same way for women. Accruing a lot of power does not make, you know, Margaret Thatcher or Hillary Clinton particularly sexually attractive to men. It's just not what human males are attracted to. They're attracted to cues of reproductive potential and cues of, you know, good genes and health and youth and all of that, but not necessarily power and status.
Right, and this is why men will date the barista, but women will not. Women want the guy with resources who shows bravery, and guys don't care. Are you hot? Do you look fertile? Basically, beauty is in the adaptations of the beholder, Don Simon said, I think.
Yeah,
yeah, it was
exactly.
Don Simon.
Well, there was this great line, and it's a very sad line from, a feminist named Germaine Greer, who's a brilliant, brilliant woman, and she was in debate with Norman Mailer, and it was this really wonderful line. It was a very sad line from her. It's like, she said, "We love men for their accomplishments all the time, and when was the last time a man loved a woman for hers?" And it's a very sad and very true line. But it's just, I think, you know, what she was saying is, well, you know, that's the way it is, unfortunately.
Yeah, and men do appreciate, they're with someone, they appreciate what the person does, but they're not hot for it the way women are. And it's just one of those differences that people don't like to admit.
When we come back, I want you to tell us about your career as a fighter. We're back. We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Gottschall about his book, The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch.
What kind of guys do MMA fighting? You know, I was sort of surprised by that. Why? Who are the guys and why are they there?
Well, when I first went across the street, I assumed they would be, you know, I don't know, sadists or bullies or borderline, you know, psychopaths or something. I don't know, just because it doesn't seem like very much fun. Who would want to make their hobby, you know, doing violence to other people? But then I go across the street and I start interviewing these guys and talking to them and training with them, fighting with them. And I find they're just like me. These are very nice young men. They are there not because they want to hurt people, but really they're there because they're looking for some sort of test, some sort of challenge, some sort of quest in their life. And cage fighting is awfully good for that. It's a way to have a sort of controlled test, a controlled way to confront your fears, to find out about yourself. And, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, were the opposite of the bully types that I was expecting to meet. They were very much, much closer to the guys who were bullied. Because, you know, one of the things you find in martial arts is people don't go into it when they know they're strong. People go into it when they fear they're weak. So these guys go, they get in these fights, and what they're doing, they're really doing is they're not fighting the other guy, they're fighting themselves. They're fighting and trying to defeat a certain weakness and timidity inside themselves that they don't respect.
Did you feel that you changed as a person from doing this? How long was the period of that you were training?
I did about 15 months before my fight, and then about close to 2 years afterward, until the wheels completely fell off physically, and I had to back out. But that was the big shocker to me. The big shocker to me was, you know, I expected to do this for a year, just so I could learn enough not to die in my fight. But then I was going to quit, you know, the minute the fight ended. But within a few months, I was like, you know, this is more fun than anything I've ever done. And so the big surprise to me was how much I liked it. And I didn't like it because, you know, I found this illicit pleasure in hurting people and doing violence to people. That wasn't it at all. What I liked about it was it forces you to be your best and strongest self. And it forces you to move out and to be part of a very tightly knit social world. And, you know, the emotions of it were not the violent emotions. The emotions to me, and I think to most of my friends who I trained with, were the emotions basically of childhood roughhousing. So you're punching each other in the face and you're grown men, but the emotions behind it are very much the glee of little boys at play. And so I just had a tremendously good time doing it.
Yeah, I loved seeing that throughout the book, even when you were getting beaten up by people and not quite responding properly to a punch and getting a black eye and coming home. And you have two girls and a wife,
yeah.
Two little girls. How did you feel about your interactions with them around the fighting?
I hid it from the girls. The girls are very little, and I didn't want them to worry about me when I went off to the gym at night. And so I told them I was taking a wrestling class, you know, not a fighting class, not fighting training, but wrestling training. But my older daughter, who was 9 at the time, figured it out. You know, she kind of overheard enough, and right before my fight, she sort of confronted me with it. She said, "Are you going to go fight? You know, are you going to go be in one of those wrestling tournaments?" You know, and I kind of had to confess that I was. And she says, "You know, you're going to lose bad, you know." And then my other daughter came up and grabbed me by the face and, like, very solemnly and says, "Please, Daddy, I don't want you to die." So none of the females in my family had any faith in my fighting skills, it turned out.
Well, also, you know, women, we don't fight physically. And you point out why that female honor throughout history has been very different from male honor. And it's defined
right.
as in terms of chastity, fidelity, modesty.
Yeah.
And you say, I love this line, courage can be proved in a gunfight that chastity cannot.
That's right. That's right. You know, if chastity could be proved by a gunfight, women might do it. But women compete over honor all the time. And they fight about it. It's the most common class of insults among women. Did you see in the book, I love this one from these medieval French women standing and calling
yeah.
each other whores. And, you know, she rinsed out her ass, you know, and whore, doubly a whore, she rinsed out her ass. You know, these peasant women yelling out insults at each other. Yeah, I love that too. I just love that.
Women usually fight covertly, though. You know, it's
right.
just it is rare that women do that, and they're so exposed like that. But I guess, you know, you're screaming at somebody for being a hooker. You know, it's just sort of already a different level.
Yeah.
One of the things that was really interesting to me was fighting eyes. And you say that men do this thing, they stare another man down, and that they're often, these dominance hierarchies between men are managed less by fights than by dually eyes. And this
yeah,
is in,
yeah,
in
I thought it was incredible. Yeah,
humans,
I mean,
and
any of your listeners can try this out just by asking a friend to have a friendly staring contest. Or don't even ask, just start staring at another person. And if the two people are female, it's a little weird, but it's not as aggressive. Women are much more tolerant of eye contact. So when women are together, like in a social setting, they'll hold eye contact for a pretty long time. But if you get two men together, eye contact is very brief and it's very glancing. And in fact, guys will sort of set up at 45 degree angles to each other so they're not like squared up to each other, so they don't to avoid the dangers of eye contact, because for men, direct eye contact is almost always interpreted as aggressive or as challenging. And we're not alone in this. There's like 30 different primate species that get involved in these eye contact duels, where most times, just by the dominant male staring at the beta male, they can hash out and reestablish their dominance hierarchies and not have to fight it out. And in people, it's really not too much different.
It's so, so interesting how so much of this is about keeping the violence down. Now, we are almost out of time. I have two questions for you. One is about why we like to watch, and you describe getting caught watching a fight on video by your dad as an event akin to getting caught watching porn. And so tell us why we're like that, why people are so compelled by watching fights and violence, why we can't turn away from it.
I think we're torn. I think we're twisted in opposite directions. So my embarrassment about watching that stuff was because part of me is like, hey, you should not be celebrating violence. You should not be taking joy from people's suffering. On the other hand, you're drawn to it, and you're drawn to it for sort of mysterious reasons. Why do I like this stuff? Why do I want to watch this stuff? And at first I assumed it was just bloodlust, but I don't believe that anymore. I think the main thing that draws us to it is not bloodlust. We're drawn to it mainly because it represents the best parts of human nature, the things that we admire the most. In a fight, you see incredible courage and stamina and skill and grace and endurance and sportsmanship. So I think you go to these fights because they not, you know, this is, I'll sound like an apologist for violence, but I think we go not to dwell on or to revel in the worst aspects of human nature, but actually to celebrate and honor the best parts of human nature.
Yeah, it's so interesting because you don't think about that, the bravery and all the stuff that goes into that, and that's throughout your book. And I've been talking with Jonathan Gottschall, and his book is The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. And this would not be complete. And by the way, it's supposed to be a half hour, not an hour. I said an hour at the beginning. Sorry about that, everybody. But I wanted to ask you about your fight. Tell us what happened and how you felt differently afterward.
I trained for about 15 months. And in some ways, I got a lot better. You know, I took my training very seriously because I didn't want to die. And I was really, it seemed quite plausible to me that I could die. I lost spectacularly. I lost very quickly. It was kind of a stunner. I felt a lot of shame afterwards, which kind of surprised me. My goal had never really been to win the fight, but just to sort of compete bravely. But I drove home that night after the fights, and I was sort of, you know, taking notes onto my MP3 player, and I was, you know, talking about my own performance, but I was also thinking about what I'd learned in the larger project. And part of it was just a little bit of a gentler attitude towards men, a little bit of a more empathetic attitude towards the sort of, I don't know, the sort of struggles that men face, the sort of silly struggles it might seem from the outside that men face just to be men. And I had sort of, I don't know, I just had a little bit more affection for men at the end of the project than I did going into the beginning.
And one of the things I just have to say I loved at the end, it turned out the guy who beat you, I think it was in 47 seconds, that he was going to school to become a nurse, and he was really kind of a sweet guy.
He's the greatest guy in the world. We're like BFFs.
I love that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we are out of time. Thank you. This has just been a great show. This is Amy Alcon's Human Lab, The Science Between Us. Dr. Jonathan Gottschall, his book is The Professor in the Cage, Why Men Fight and Why We Like to Watch. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Amy.
Hey, I'm here at your Metro PCS store. What's the best deal I can get for switching over?
How does a free smartphone sound?
Sounds good, but is it a tiny smartphone?